Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover the whole of chapter 8 in Judges, verses 1 through 35. I'll entitle this section, Gideon Defeats Zeba and Zalmunna. These are two of the remaining leaders of Midian. The first main two leaders, Oreb and Zeb, have been killed already because they got stopped at the fords of Beth Araba near the Jabbok River in the Jordan Valley, trying to cross back over into the eastern Transjordan area after they had gotten whooped by Gideon's 300 men at Mount Moriah in the Valley of Jezreel. That was our context. That happened in the last chapter, chapter 7. So now we begin in Judges 8, verses 1 through 3. Then the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, "What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they contended with Gideon vigorously. But Gideon said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. Now, this is somewhere either before or after the crossing of the Jordan, after the big battle was won by the 300 at Mount Moriah, or in the valleys below Mount Moriah, the famous breaking of the pitcher with the torches inside battle. And the Midianites, what was left of them, not many, 15,000 of them, have retreated back, and they got to the ford to cross over, and the Ephraimites, called up belatedly by Gideon, rushed out and stopped them. But Ephraim was not called to fight the original battle up at in the valleys of Mount Moriah in the Jezreel Valley. So, this is what the people of Ephraim are complained about. Now, why didn't Joshua call out the people of Ephraim first? In my opinion, it's because they were too far away to do any good up there in the Jezreel Valley. He called them out when he needed them. But nonetheless, the men of Ephraim complained. "Why did you call us out?" It's a good time for them to complain because they had just done Gideon's service by killing Oreb and Zeb and Zeb, Wolf and Raven, the two leaders of Midian who were killed. And so they felt it was a politic time to complain to Gideon. Now, why were they angry? I read somewhere that they were nearer than the other tribes that Gideon did call, but looking at a map, I don't see that. They're further south of Manasseh, and the Jezreel Valley's north of Manasseh, so I don't think that's it. I think the reason that they were angry is that they were jealous. They were afraid that Ephraim would lose its preeminence to Manasseh. Now, recall, Ephraim is preeminent to Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh were both descendants of Joseph, but Jacob had given the preeminence, Joseph's father, Jacob, had given the preeminence to Ephraim over Manasseh when he was parceling out his inheritance in Genesis 48 and 49. Let's read Genesis 48, verse 14. "But Israel," that's Jacob, "stretched out his right hand and put it on the head of Ephraim, the younger, and crossing his hands, put his left on Manasseh's head, although Manasseh was the firstborn." Well, the blessing went with the right hand. The younger got it. Normally the older got it. So Ephraim had the preeminence over Manasseh. And now Manasseh's getting all the glory because Gideon was from the tribe of Manasseh. Gideon is getting all the glory, and I suspect Ephraim is jealous. In fact, we can see in Isaiah 9, verse 21, that there was an old and deep-seated feeling of jealous rivalry between those two tribes. Isaiah 9, 21 says this, "Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh, and together they are against Judah. Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim devours Manasseh." Well, for whatever reason, and it's speculation as to why they were upset, we can see the ingratitude of the Ephraimites, because when Gideon won, the Ephraimites were benefited as much as any tribe, and they didn't have to fight for it. You would think they'd be happy. And besides, Ephraim could have volunteered their services. They conveniently forgot to mention that. And Gideon graciously doesn't bring it up, but you know, they're complaining, "Why weren't we called?" Well, you could have volunteered, Ephraim, but you didn't. So you got the advantage of knocking out a terrible enemy that's wiping out all your crops every year. You can't grow wheat, you can't grow barley, you can't. Your flocks and your herds are in danger of getting stolen every year. And now without shedding one drop of blood, that's all over with. And now you're complaining? Well, Gideon is presented with an unfortunate situation here. But Gideon, as we'll see, is very diplomatic. And in fact, the result of his talk is that the Ephraimites' anger towards getting subsided. So he talked them down. Now, how did he do it? First thing he did, he praised them. He said, hey, what have I done in comparison with you? What he meant was, is they killed Oreb and Zeb, two leaders of Midian, where Gideon, all he did was break some clay pitchers with torches in them. Well, that's being extremely modest, but that's the way Gideon is playing it here. He's trying to butter up the Ephraimites. I say Gideon is modest. I mean, after all, he took 300 men and scattered a force of 132,000. That's pretty good. I think he did more than the Ephraimites did, but he's flattering them. And he uses a proverb to do it. He says in verse 2, the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim, isn't that better than the vintage of Abiezer? Abiezer is Gideon's father's name, and so Gideon is referring to his tribe in Manasseh. The vintage is collecting all of the grapes, harvesting them, and preparing them for pressing in the wine press. Well, after the vintage is over, that which is left in the trees can be gleaned by the poor. And so Gideon uses this agricultural practice to make a metaphor. He says, the vintage of Abiezer is not as important as the gleaning of the grapes by Ephraim. And what he means is, I started the fight. The vintage is the process, the gathering of the grapes to start the grape harvest. I started. After the harvesting of the grapes was finished, then the gleaning took place, and that's Ephraim. They finished the fight. But now the finish of the fight, the gleaning of the grapes, is better because, hey, you got Oreb and Zeb. You killed them. I didn't do that. So again, this is schmoozing, because what Gideon did was obviously much greater than what the Ephraimites did. So their anger having been subsided, the Ephraimites' anger has been subsided. So now we go to verse 4 in Judges 8. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. I'm assuming this is near the Jabbok River, near Beth Araba, the ford there that was mentioned in the last chapter. Gideon had not lost one man, because 300 men are still with him. Either in the attack in the valleys at Mount Moriah in the Jezreel Valley, they didn't lose anybody, or in pursuing the Midianites down to the ford there at the Jabbok River, no losses. I'm assuming 300 is not a round number. I mean, they could have lost one, and it was 299, and the author rounded to 300, but I don't think so. I think Gideon came out losing nobody. They were weary. After all, they'd been up all night. Remember, it was in the second watch between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning when they fought that battle at Mount Moriah, below Mount Moriah, and they were blowing trumpets and attacking the Midianites, and so they were worn out, and they were chasing, too, so they were tired. We go now to Judges 8, verses 5 through 7. He, that's Gideon, said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. That's who had taken over now that Oreb and Zeb were dead. Verse 6, the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? Gideon said, all right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. So the people of Succoth were not nice. They wouldn't feed Gideon's hungry army. Now let's do some geography. Now the Jabbok River runs into the Jordan River near Adam, the famous place where the water stacked up when Joshua crossed. You go up several miles and right to the east of the Jordan River in the valley there, in the Jordan Valley, is Succoth. Now Succoth is a sort of a famous place. It was in the tribe of Gad in the Transjordan area. It was inhabited by Israelites, of course, because the Israelites got the Transjordan area, and that was Gad's territory. It got its name from the booths or tents, because Succoth means booth, or tents, which Jacob erected there. That's when Jacob came back from Padam Aram from Syria, getting his wife, Rebekah. Genesis 33:17, Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Booths, that's what Succoth means. Therefore, the place is named Succoth. So, Succoth has got an interesting history for that reason. Let's see what Easton says about Succoth. It's a city on the east of Jordan, the plain north of the Jabbok River, about 1 mile from the Jabbok River. Here Jacob, on his return from Padam Aram, after his interview with Esau, built a house for himself and made booths for his cattle. The princes of the city churlishly refused to afford help to Gideon and his 300 men when fate yet pursuing. They followed one of the bands of the fugitive Mennonites after the great victory at, well, Easton says Gilboa, but I think he's Easton's is thinking Gilboa is a manuscript error for Mount Gilead, which nobody knows what that is or where it is, the ones on a western Mount Gilead. So let's just say after the great victory in the Jezreel Valley, after overtaking and routing this band at Karkor, Gideon, on his return, visited the rulers of this city, Succoth, with severe punishment. We'll get a little bit of foreshadowing here. He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught, the men of Succoth taught, that's an understatement. At this place were erected the foundries for casting the metalwork for the temple. Another little interesting factoid. That's in 1 Kings 7, verse 46. Now notice that Gideon, when he goes to the leaders of Succoth, he says, please. He was very nice. He was very polite. He didn't demand. He didn't command. He didn't demand more troops, more weapons. He just wanted a little bit of bread. Ordinary bread, not delicacies, not steak, not hamburgers, not pizza, just bread. They wouldn't give it to him. And as he asks, while he's asking this, Zeba and Zalmunna, whom Gideon tells the leaders of Succoth that he's pursuing, Zeba and Zalmunna are probably ravaging Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh, all the two and a half tribes on the east of the Jordan. Now, notice that this victory that Gideon got on the west side of the Jordan also helped Succoth on the east side of the Jordan. Because remember, Midian is wiping everybody out, not just the western Israelites, but also the eastern Israelites too, and now they don't have to worry about getting their crops plundered. But oh no, they're not going to feed 300 men. They're not going to give 300 men some bread. Why? Well, the men of Succoth were afraid that Gideon's 300 weren't going to beat Midian's 15,000 that were left, and that's understandable, although the 300 had already beat the 100 and however many, over 100,000 that were already beaten. I think it was 132,000, something like that. I forgot the numbers right now, but Gideon already beat a whopping number of Midianites with just 300, so it's reasonable to think he could beat 15,000, but on the other hand, it's reasonable to think he might not, so that's probably why they refused to support Gideon at that point, because if they had, they would be subject to retribution from Midian in case Midian beat Gideon later on. So their refusal seems somewhat reasonable. However, it really wasn't reasonable, because if Gideon had been beaten, Israel would be enslaved again, and Succoth was a part of Israel. So when Gideon is going to fight Midian, they're fighting for Succoth, and Succoth's not going to help out any because they're scared of retribution. Well, they're going to get plundered if Midian wins. So, no, it wasn't reasonable. They should have helped Gideon. They didn't do it. Now, notice in verse 7, Gideon says, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand. He doesn't say if the Lord does that. He said when the Lord does that. That shows how much confidence he has. And remember, Gideon didn't start out this whole process being very confident. He had to ask God for fleeces, a couple fleeces to get some faith. He asked God for a sign, the angel of Jehovah, Jesus, and Jesus torched Gideon's goat and bread food that was on a stone altar in Ophrah. So God had already shown him three signs already to get him up to snuff here, to get him brave enough to fight this battle. He's brave now. He's won the battle. He's seen God work miracles, and he just assumes he's going to get Zeba and Zalmunna. It's just a matter of time. And he says what he's going to do, he's going to come back after he gets Zeba and Zalmunna, and he is going to thrash the leaders of Succoth. Is that figurative or is that literal? If it's literal, it means he was going to whip and scourge the leaders of Succoth with briars. He was going to lay them on briars and walk on their bodies, perhaps. Jameson Fawcett Brown thinks that's what that means. He says, quote, a cruel torture to which captives were often subjected in ancient times by having thorns and briars placed on their naked bodies and pressed down by sledges or heavy implements of husbandry being dragged over them. Think of a disc harrow being dragged over your back with thorns under it. Whew. Adam Clark says, what this punishment consisted in, I cannot say. He throws his hands up. We don't know exactly what it was, but I'm sure it wasn't pleasant, especially when you consider the light clothes that they wore back then and the nasty briars that are there found in thorns in the desert. We go down to Judges 8, verses 8 through 9. He, that's Gideon, went up from there, from Succoth, to Penuel, and spoke similarly to them. Let's just stop right here and see where Penuel is. Penuel, it means face of God. That's the name of it. It's a place not far from Succoth. I'm reading from Easton's. On the east of the Jordan and north of the river Jabbok. It is also called Peniel. Peniel or Peniel, it means face of God. Why was it called face of God? Because here Jacob wrestled with a man, the angel of Jehovah. Jacob says of him, I have seen God face to face, because he was wrestling with Jesus face to face. A town was afterwards built there at Peniel or Peniel. The men of this place refused to succor Gideon and his little army when they were in pursuit of the Midianites. That's what we just read in Judges 8. On his return, Gideon slew the men of the city and razed its lofty watchtower to the ground. Some more foreshadowing for you. Now, Easton says that Peniel is on the north of the river Jabbok. BibleAtlas.org has it just on the south of the Jabbok with a question mark, so nobody really knows where it was, but it was close by Succoth, right near the Jabbok River on the eastern side of the Jordan. Now, why did Gideon say he was going to do that later and not then, right then when he was there? Because he had to go chase Zeba and Zalmunna. He didn't have time to take care of the town of Peniel, not yet. What he was going to do when he gets back, he was going to knock down their tower, tear down their tower. And, of course, their tower was their confidence and security. If you think of a walled town, you had a tower up inside the wall where troops would stand up there so they could see well and so they could shoot weapons down on besiegers. So a tower was a military asset. Gideon says, I'm going to tear it down, so you're not going to have any more military assets. Clark speculates this, quote, probably they had not only denied Gideon, but insultingly pointed to a tower in which their chief defense lay and intimated to him, to Gideon, that he might do his worst, for they could amply defend themselves. And Gideon says, oh, no, you're not. I'm coming back and I'm going to take you down. We go to verse 10 in Judges 8. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. A minute ago, I couldn't remember how many people had gotten beat up there in the Jezreel Valley, right below Mount Moreh. 120,000, there's the number, 15,000 left. Now, where's Karkor? According to Easton's, Karkor, which means foundation, it's a place in the open desert waste on the east of Jordan, not far beyond Succoth and Peniel to the south. In other words, just close by. Clark says if this was a place, I'm assuming it's a place, it is nowhere else mentioned in Scripture. The word means rest. In other words, Clark thinks it could be translated this way. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were at rest. Well, whatever. Wherever they were surprised by Gideon. And Karkor, by the way, according to BibleAtlas.org, it's the same place as Peniel. There's no difference in the places. We go now to Judges 8, verses 11 through 12. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbaha and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Now verse 11 says, Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents. The NIV says, Gideon went up by the way of those nomads. People who lived in tents are nomads. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates caravan route. Gideon went up by the way of the caravan route on the east of Nobah and Jogbaha. Well, Nobah and Jogbaha are somewhere just to the east of where we are here. No, according to Gill, Nobah was the first city that was in the tribe of East Manasseh on the southern end of it, southern boundary of it. And Jogbaha was in the tribe of Gad, and there was a caravan route between the two. And so Gideon went on the caravan route, so he went further east. Sounds like he went east and circled back around and hit the Midianites at Karkor from the eastern side. I don't know that for sure, but it doesn't matter. Zeba and Zalmunna, after the panic, because they were unsuspecting. And why? Well, the Midianites had crossed the Jordan. They figured the Jordan River will stop any pursuit. It was nighttime. They weren't expected to get attacked at night. Of course, they'd already gotten attacked at night once before in the Jezreel Valley at Mount Moreh, but at any rate, that was a good while ago, and perhaps the Midianites thought that Gideon's army was too fatigued to attack at that time, but they did. They routed at Karkor the Midianites. Now, they might have blown their trumpets just like they did before to scare the blazes out of them. Now, the two leaders, Zeba and Zalmunna, were captured because their whole army had fled away. They had no support anymore, no army to protect them. Now, again, this is a remarkable thing. Remember, Gideon is still outnumbered 15,000 to 300. Now, that is, well, not necessarily the Ephraimites might have helped Gideon by joining in the chase at the ford of the Jordan River, Bathabar at the ford there. But even if they did, Gideon's still going to be outnumbered a good bit. And so he won another great victory by the help of the Lord. We go down to Judges 8, verses 13 through 17. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are weary? He took the elders of the city, and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Now a little geographical note here. Gideon, the son of Joash, Joash is his father, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. Remember, Karkar is somewhere near Penuel, so he beat the Midianites at Karkar, went back to Penuel, and then he went back to Succoth in reverse order, even though in the text here, Succoth is mentioned before Penuel, probably because the story is better, I don't know. The ascent of Heres means Sun Mountain. Easton says it's probably identical for the place called Irshemesh in Joshua 19:41, not very important place. KJV doesn't translate it as a geographical name. The KJV translates it as before the sun was up. So Joshua returned from battle before the sun came up. Well, if you say that he did all that in one night, that's kind of hard to believe, because we're going to see here that Joshua sent messengers to the Ephraimites. He punished Succoth and Penuel. He delivered the heads of Oreb and Zeb, or I should say the Ephraimites delivered the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon. That's in the last chapter, but the timing of that is disputed, so that might not be true. But at least during that night, a lot's going on, so it's probably not before the sun was up. Probably not one night that all this happened. Again, it doesn't really matter. Other translations of this have, Young's Literal Translation says that Joshua returned at the going up of the sun. God's Word Translation says that Joshua returned through the Heres Pass. Well, up the ascent of Heres, same thing. New American Bible says by the pass of Heres. Again, a minor detail. Verse 14 says that the elders of Succoth were 77 in number. Gideon said, who are your elders? And that youth, he must have been shaking in his boots. He wrote down all the names of the men. And so now Gideon knows who to go after. He quotes what they had told him exactly, at least in the text is exact. He said, quote, he came to the men of Succoth and said, quote, This is what you taunted me with. He said, This is what you taunted me with. Quote, Are the hands of Zeb and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are weary? Word for word. Now, I don't know if he did that by memory. Some people say he memorized those words so he could come back and troll them with it. Or it could just be that the author of the text just wrote it down word for word. I don't know. But at any rate, Gideon's not happy. But he does show wisdom and strict justice, because he only punished the leaders for their decision, only those 77 elders, not everybody in the city of Succoth. Now, the fact that there were so many elders, that shows that this was a very big city. Now, Gideon disciplined the elders either by just whipping them with the briars and humiliating them, or he could have laid them down on thorns and then walked on their backs, or as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, run farming implements over their backs as they lay on the thorns. We don't know. And it's also unknown whether they died or not. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about the acts of the people of Succoth and not giving bread to Gideon. Quote, By refusing Gideon's soldiers' refreshment, they, the people of Succoth, had committed a public crime as well as an act of inhumanity, and were subjected to a horrible punishment, which the great abundance and remarkable size of the thorn bushes, together with the thinness of clothing in the east, has probably suggested. Now note that if Midian had not been wiped out by Gideon, they would come back to scourge Israel like they had done for the last 7 years, stealing their crops, stealing their livestock, and they probably would have done it a lot worse, because they had just gotten beaten in the Jezreel Valley, and they would probably be mad as fire. So, Succoth's refusal to help Gideon's band could have resulted in the destruction of Israel, and where would the nation of Israel be for the Messiah to be born into? So this is a big deal. So, don't feel sorry for these guys, because they got scourged with briars. Now, the last verse 17 here jumps back to Peniel, which Gideon had already been through, and torn down the tower. It's logical that Gideon tore that down before discipline Succoth, because he's going back in reverse order from the way he came. He went from Succoth to Peniel to Karkar, and now he's going from Karkar to Peniel to Succoth. Now in verse 17, it says that Gideon killed the men of the city. He didn't do so at Succoth. Why was the difference? Well, it's probably because the men of Peniel tried to resist Gideon when Gideon tore down the tower, and so in the battle, people got killed. It's unlikely that Gideon indiscriminately killed non-combatants just because he wanted to. It was probably soldiers killed in action, because he didn't do it at Succoth, and he very well could have, so I doubt he did it at Peniel either. We go now to Judges 8, verses 18 through 21. Then he, that's Gideon, said to Zeba and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" And they said, "They were like you, each one resembling the son of a king." He, that's Gideon, said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise, kill them." But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength." So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Now where are we now? Are we still at Karkar? Are we going back to Peniel, to Succoth? Maybe all the way back to Ophir? I don't know where they are. I doubt they went back all the way. What John Gill says, they may have gone all the way back to Ophir, but it doesn't really say. This is sort of a sidebar to the main story. Gideon says, "Hey, you killed Zeba and Zalmunna. You guys killed some people at Tabor." Now, where is Tabor? Well, it's probably Mount Tabor. It could be the city, as Colin Delitzsch say. But if you look at the map, you look at the southern, southeastern end of the Jezreel Valley as it approaches the Jordan River, and you look at the northern side of the Jezreel Valley down there near the Jordan Valley, and you will see a northern mountain, a mountain on the north side called Tabor, which is right north of Mount Moreh, where the around the base of which the battle, the first battle of Gideon versus the Midianites took place. This is the Mount Tabor that many people speculate the Mount of Transfiguration took place on, with absolutely no evidence. Now, apparently some Israelites had hidden themselves at Tabor, the city or the mountain, before the battle. The commentator Benson said, quote, "Gideon understood his brethren had fled for shelter upon the approach of the Midianites." His brethren, that means his blood brothers. Now, Gideon had probably noticed they were missing sometime during the battle, and this prompted his question, like, "Where are my brothers?" He said, "These are the sons of my mother," in verse 19. Now, somebody, and I don't know who did this because I didn't write it down, but somebody's made the argument that these were Gideon's full blood brothers, not half brothers, because it says he's the sons of their mother, and therefore they were closer to Gideon. So now Gideon is the legal avenger of blood. His blood kin were killed, and so now he's a kinsman avenger, and he can kill them. Otherwise, he would not be able to morally kill them, not by the law of nations, because Zeba and Zalmunna were prisoners of war, and you don't kill prisoners of war. But now, wait a minute. I don't buy that argument. For first of all, and the argument further goes, that also not only by the law of nations, the law of the Gentiles, but by the law of Moses, because the law only commanded death for Canaanites, and Zeba and Zalmunna weren't Canaanites. They were from the east. So what do we think of this argument? Well, it's no good, I don't think, because first of all, just because it says that the deceased were the sons of Gideon's mother, that doesn't mean they were full brothers. They could be half brothers. They could have the same mother and different fathers. Second is, you mean that the law of the Gentiles, the law of nations, would forbid somebody from executing somebody who had murdered in cold blood? Because that's what apparently these Zeba and Zalmunna had done. They came upon Gideon's brothers hiding at Mount Tabor and offed them, executed them, killed them. Well, hey, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So I think it was perfectly moral for Gideon to kill these people because he was executing justice. The Midianite kings got what they deserved, justice for cold-blooded murder of innocent citizens. Now Gideon says in verse 19, "As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you." See, he's executing justice, and unfortunately, they murdered, and so they died too. But Gideon was perfectly willing to let them live, even though they were defeated kings in battle. So Gideon asked Jether to carry out the execution. Why did Gideon ask his son Jether to do that? He has three options. Option one, to greater mortify Ziba and Zalmunna, because they would die by the hands of a young stripling, a young boy, and that would be... And the ancient kings were real picky about how they died back then. They were big on honor, and so this would be a dishonor to them. Second reason why Gideon might have gotten Jether to do it was to honor his son. His son at a very young age would be the slayer of two kings. Third possible option that Gideon asked Jether to do it was to train and toughen his son. But Jether didn't want to do it, and I frankly don't blame him. I get squeamish when I think about chopping people's heads off with swords. I think Gideon was very gracious to his son not to force him to do it, so Gideon did it. Now, verse 20, it says, the youth, that's Jether, Gideon's son, did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. What was he afraid of? Was he afraid of physical harm from the kings? No, they were tied up. They're not going to get him. It's probably the thought of killing in general made him squeamish. They were afraid. John Gill says maybe a certain majesty in the appearance of the kings frightened him. I don't think so. Kings were tied up. What kind of majesty are you going to have being tied up? He just probably didn't like the thought of killing people. Verse 21, Ziba and Zalmunna say, rise up yourself, Gideon. You kill us. If you want to be a man, you need to show yourself strong. That's basically what, for as the man, so is his strength. In other words, if you're a man, you're going to be strong. You could do it. So Gideon said, okay, I'll oblige you. Bam, he arose and whacked them. And then he took the crested ornaments which were on their camel's necks. These ancient warriors love to take booty. That has never changed. Why would Ziba and Zalmunna prefer to be executed by Gideon rather than Jether, the son? Well, they prefer to die by the hand of a great man and a commander as Gideon. That's a psychological reason. Also maybe a physical reason. Gideon is stronger, so their death is less likely to be lingering and painful. Now, that's something you don't think about, because when you read all these executions in the Middle Ages when people were beheaded, people just feared rookie executioners who weren't able to chop the head off of one blow, because it doesn't hurt if your head gets chopped off of one blow, but if it gets hacked and hacked and hacked, And that's probably what would have happened with Jether. He wouldn't be able to execute him with one blow. So that's a good practical reason why they preferred Gideon to Jether. We go now to Judges 8, verses 22 and 23. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Well, now Gideon has a chance to be a big shot, because everybody's so happy with this marvelous victory that is run, that he has won. So the men of Israel say, hey, rule over us, both you and your son and your son's son. And that's probably hypothetical. It probably doesn't mean that the grandson of Gideon is living at this point yet. Jether is still a young lad. He's alive. Where are they now? They're probably, they could be at Succoth still. They could be all the way back home in Ophrah. We're not given the geographical detail. Now, verse 22, when it says, rule over us, you and your son and your son's son, what they're talking about is hereditary monarchy. Now, there's nothing worse than a hereditary monarchy. If you read Middle Ages history, as I've spent a lot of time doing, the one thing that you didn't want is to let the son inherit the king, because, oh my gosh, the sons are usually incompetent or evil or just stupid or just, it just rarely works out. In fact, the Saxon kings, before the Normans took over in England, they had a witan, a W-I-T-A-N, I guess that's how you pronounce that. They had a council of nobles that elected a king. But these guys want an hereditary king so they can invest the kingship, invest the monarchy with sacred worth and power. Well, Gideon says, no, I'm not going to rule. I've got a call from God to be a judge, but not a king. He resisted the temptation to be a king, which shows how wise he was. One of my commentators says this, quote, personal and family ambition was cheerfully sacrificed to a sense of duty, and every worldly motive was kept in check by a supreme regard to the divine honor. And besides, the people did not have a right to choose a king. If anyone had a right to choose a king, Gideon did. It was he who had won the battle, not the people. Here's what Gill says about this. What a weak, foolish, and inconstant people were these. As yet, their government was a theocracy, and now, dazzled with the success of a man who was only an instrument in the hands of God to deliver them from their enemies, they wished to throw off the divine yoke and shackle themselves with an unlimited hereditary monarchy. An unlimited monarchy is a curse. And that's why England got rid of their unlimited monarchy. They have a ceremonial monarchy. America got rid of its unlimited monarchy also. Now in verse 23, when Gideon says, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. What did he mean when he said, my son's not going to rule over you? It could be he's rejecting hereditary monarchy, which is, I think, what it is. But he could also be speaking prophetically, because all of Gideon's sons were later killed by Abimelech, his concubine's son. That's the next chapter, but that's after he died. So I think he's just basically saying, I don't think he's a prophet here. I think he's just saying, no, we're not going to have an hereditary monarchy, not while I'm alive. We go now to verses 24 through 27. Yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. For they had gold earrings, because they were Ishmaelites. And they there is the enemies, the Midianites. They, that's the other soldiers, Gideon's soldiers, they said, we will surely give them. So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. Well, now we got the bad news. First of all, was Gideon's request reasonable that all of the soldiers give him a gold earring from the spoil, a gold earring for each of the Ishmaelites that were killed or captured? The people didn't think it was unreasonable. They said, sure, we'll give it to you. Now, Gideon says, I request of you. Who's the you that he's talking about? The sons of Israel, probably. He's talking to Israelites back up in verse 22. The men of Israel said to Gideon, and so Gideon says to them, so he's talking to the men of Israel, that would include the people who came over to fight on the eastern side of the Jordan. That had to be more than the original 300. The Ephraimites must have helped, because 300 people, one earring for 300 people is not going to end up with 1,700 shekels, which is 43 pounds of gold, which is a heap of gold. So he's probably talking about more soldiers. In fact, I think that proves that there's more than 300 that crossed the Jordan. The Ephraimites must have come and helped. Now the parenthetical remark in verse 24 said they, that means the Midianites, had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Well, how are the Midianites also called Ishmaelites? The New American Bible here in verse 24 translates that verse, for being Ishmaelites, the enemy had gold rings. A little better translation, I think. It's clearer. So the Ishmaelites had gold rings in the ear. Why weren't they called Midianites there? Well, Gill says Midianites and Ishmaelites are often spoken of as the same, because they mixed together and they dwelt together, and it was hard to distinguish them. Sometimes at least they dwelt very near to each other if they weren't actually mixed together in their dwelling places. Now we can see this in Genesis 37 in three verses, verse 25, verse 28, and verse 36. Verse 25 says, then they sat down to eat a meal. As they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites. This is the patriarchs, the 12 sons of Jacob. They sat down to eat, and they looked, and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead on the way to Egypt. And drop down to verse 28, then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites. So Midianites sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites, so there sounds like they're two different people there. But then we go down to verse 36, behold, the Midianites sold him in Egypt. So in verse 28, it says the Ishmaelites brought Joseph into Egypt. In verse 36, it says the Midianites sold him in Egypt. So they appear to be the same. But in verse 28, they appear to be different. Then some Midianite traders passed by, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. So the distinction is made there between the Midianites and Ishmaelites, but they're blurred together in verse 36. So, interesting little factoid. The gold earrings that Gideon got, 1,700 shekels, as I said. The NIV margin says that's 43 pounds, about 19.5 kilograms, which is a fortune, by the way. That's a lot of gold. A lot more than 300 soldiers could have given Gideon. So that proves that more than 300 soldiers crossed the Jordan, which proves that Ephraim helped Gideon here. Now, there's some other plunder besides the earrings. Verse 26 says, besides the 1,700 shekels of gold, that's the earrings, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes, which are on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on the camel's neck. So the kings had jewelry and stuff and clothes, and the camels had jewelry, and Gideon apparently got that because he was a general. In other words, he got the earrings besides all that other stuff. The earrings were given to him by the people, as John Yule says, but he earned the other plunder because he was the general. Now, Gideon took his gold and made an ephod. Now, this was stupid, in my humble opinion. Why in the world would he do that? An ephod, of course, is a breast piece, the ephod that was used by the high priest who ministered at the tabernacle as set up on the Exodus at Mount Sinai. We went through great detail describing that ephod. Had the 12 colored stones on the front representing the 12 tribes of Israel. I suspect that this ephod probably mimicked the high priest ephod. If it did, that's even worse, because now you're setting up illegal worship. The tabernacle is now either at Shiloh or Shechem, I'm not sure where, but it's not in Ophrah. And Gideon might have set up that ephod because he thought of himself as a priest. He had already built an altar there, remember? Put that 7-year bull on the altar after he tore down the altar of Baal. If he has an ephod, hey, well, I don't need to go down to Shiloh where the tabernacle is to sacrifice there. I can sacrifice right here. Save me a trip. Besides, Shiloh's in Ephraim, and I'm a Manassite. I don't want to go down to Ephraim. People in the Ephraimites don't like me because I'm a Manassite. So I'm just going to have a altar up here in Ophrah in the tribe of Manasseh. And Gideon might have also used that ephod as an oracle, because remember, the original ephod, the Levitical one, had a breastplate and was folded. The breastplate was folded, and in the fold of that breastplate was kept the Urim and Thummim, whatever that was. I always think of a black rock and a white rock. Nobody knows. But it was somehow that was used to consult as an oracle the mind of God. Maybe Gideon said, okay, well, I'm just going to use this to consult the mind of God too. Maybe, or maybe it was just a memorial trophy. It's hard to say. Now, here's a question. Should Gideon have made the golden ephod? Here's what Gill says, quote, though he cannot be altogether excused from sin and weakness in making it, but after his death, it was soon made an ill use of. In other words, he was only sort of guilty in doing it. He was only sort of weak in doing it. But boy, after he died, things got really bad. Well, I don't think that's an excuse, to be perfectly honest with you. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about it. Quote, that no idolatrous use was in view, nor any divisive course from Shiloh contemplated, is manifest from Judges 8:33. That verse, Judges 8:33, which we'll get to in a minute, says that after Gideon died, Israel played the harlot, and that implies that they didn't do it until Gideon died, and therefore you could infer from that the ephod was not used for any kind of adulterous purposes until then. Right, that's reasonable. Gideon proposed, continue Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, with the gold he received, to make an ephod for his use only as a civil magister or ruler, just as David did. In 1 Chronicles 15:27, we read, now David was clothed with a robe of fine linen with all the Levites. David also wore an ephod of linen. Of course, David was not criticized for that. It was just for show, just for a piece of cloth, and so Gideon might have been perfectly innocent, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Gill says he was a little bit guilty. Let's see what Clark says. Quote, his motive in making the ephod is not well understood. Probably it was done with no reprehensible design. But the act was totally wrong. He had no divine authority to make such an innovation in the religious worship of his country. The ark was at Shechem again. People don't know whether it was at Shechem, at Shiloh. Clark says it was at Shechem. And there was the proper and only accredited priest. The act, therefore, can never be excused, whatever may be said of his motive. In other words, either he deliberately tried to commit adultery or he stupidly committed adultery. At any rate, it's a blemish on his record. Verse 27 says that the ephod became a snare. As we'll read in the next chapter, it led his family into idolatry. Bad business. Became a snare to Gideon and his household. We're going to see that Gideon's descendants are going to get wiped out as a result of all that idolatry. Verse 26 says that Gideon got all the purple that the kings had, Zeba and Zalmunna. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it was the purple on the camels, not the kings. I don't think so. We go to Judges 8, verses 28 through 32. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads any more. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, that's Gideon, the contender against Baal, the Baal fighter, because he tore down his father's Baal altar a couple chapters ago. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. So he's back at Ophrah now. Now Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. I guess so. You got 70 sons, you have to have a lot of wives, because I don't think one woman could have 70 sons. Verse 31, his concubine who was in Shechem also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Now, I don't know if that means there were 70 sons plus Abimelech. That probably includes Abimelech. Verse 32, and Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Again, the Abiezrites is that family of Manasseh that Gideon belonged to. Now, the sons are the Midianites, did not lift up their heads anymore. In other words, there's no more pride in Midian now. The lifting up your head means you're cocky and arrogant. No, sir, not anymore. 40 years of peace. So that was a good deal that Gideon did. And that's 40 years is probably after the 7 years of Midianite subjugation. It probably doesn't include that because it's peace. They weren't really undisturbed during that 7 year period. Now Gideon goes back to his house in Ophrah in verse 29, that does not mean he lived a private life in Ophrah. He continued to judge Israel. He is said here to have 70 sons in verse 30. I assume he also had other daughters who are not mentioned, because I can't believe that his wives would all have boys and no girls. So that boy was busy in the bedroom. And when it says he had 70 sons, they were his direct descendants. That means born of his body. None of them were adopted. None of them came from a wife's previous marriage and became his stepchildren when he married a wife. No, they were all produced by his sperm alone. Boy, what a man. Now, his son Abimelech, who's going to be famous in the next chapter, was born of a concubine. How is a concubine different than a wife? A concubine was a wife. I always like to call them a junior wife. They didn't manage household affairs. Their children didn't inherit, but they were legally married. You couldn't have sex with her. If you did, if another person besides the husband, I should say, had sex with her, it was considered adultery. Now, Abimelech, who's mentioned here, the name of Abimelech means my father a king. Now, that's ironic since Gideon was offered the kingship and turned it down. Why did Gideon name him Abimelech, my father a king, even though he knew he was not a king? Maybe he was trying to memorialize that offer to make him a king, even though he didn't actually take the Israelites up on the offer. I don't think so. Here's a better option. This is from Gill and Clark. Abimelech's mother probably persuaded Gideon to name Abimelech, my father a king, because she was proud and she was vain. She was hoping his name would inspire him to be a king, and by golly, this concubine would be the mother of a king. We go now to Judges 8, verses 33 through 35. Then it came about, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who would deliver them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. As soon as Gideon was dead, bang! They're off into idolatry. That shows that Gideon was probably keeping the lid on things until he died. And that tends to make you think that the people were not worshiping that golden ephod that Gideon built, but we don't know that. Now, verse 33, it says they played the harlot. Now, what does that mean? Well, Adam Clark says they could have been physical harlotry, too. They could have been shacking up with religious prostitutes who were serving the temples of Baal. The Israelites made Baal-berith their god. That Baal probably got his name from Berytus. I guess that's how you pronounce that, B-E-R-Y-T-U-S. That's a city on the Mediterranean coast north of Israel in Phoenicia, present-day Lebanon. That's where this Baal was first worshipped. This is 50 miles north of Sidon. It later became a seat of learning, and today we know it as Beirut. So this is the Baal of Beirut. Berith, by the way, means covenant. So this is the Baal of the covenant, Lord of the covenant. Which is kind of interesting that present-day Beirut has its name comes from covenant. The sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God. Total ingratitude for all that God had done. How soon the people forget. And I tell you, any Christian that forgets what God has done for them and returns to his vomit and backslides is a first-rate idiot and an ingrate to do that. I don't care how bad things get. We all deserve to die and be in hell. And with every little favor that God does for us, we need to be thankful for. Verse 35 says, the sons of Israel did not show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, Gideon does all that for him, and then the people there in Ophrah and surrounding areas treat Gideon's descendants badly. That's really an understatement, because we're going to see later on in the next chapter, they kill them all, kill those 70 sons. So a little bit of flies have landed in the honey. It's been a glorious several chapters as Gideon won all over the place, established peace for 40 years, and then the Israelites couldn't make it last to the next generation. So, ladies and gentlemen, we will now turn in our next audio to chapter 9. We're going to need to split that chapter up. It's pretty long. The next audio, I'll do the first 27 verses, Abimelech's conspiracy, the same Abimelech, the son of this concubine that we just talked about. He has a conspiracy. He wants to be king. And then the next audio will finish up that chapter and continue to look at Abimelech's conspiracy, part 2. I hope you stay tuned to listen to that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.